Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, August 11th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. There was a world historic event which occurred last Sunday night. NASA's Mars rover, named Curiosity, made a perfect pinpoint landing in a crater on Mars after a flight of more than 350 million miles. This successful landing introduced a wave of scientific and technological optimism in our nation and has led Lyndon LaRouche to proclaim this as the possible development which could bring down President Obama and his greeny fascist supporters. LaRouche wrote a leaflet on the new potential unleashed by this event, which we distributed today at a labor rally in Philadelphia. I want to read a segment of this to you, and this leaflet is posted on the LaRouche PAC website under the title, Remember President Kennedy. And LaRouche says that especially since the triumphant flight of Curiosity, there is also a recently increased emphasis on mission orientations toward the defense of human life on Earth against threats from objects which threaten human life on Earth. Similarly, the recent brilliant success of the landing of Curiosity into its assigned region on Mars has unleashed a rising wave of optimism respecting mankind's ability to organize a defense of human life against menacing objects in nearby space. These developments have sparked a greatly increased enthusiasm for mankind's possibilities for accelerated scientific labors of multiple importance for us on Earth itself. A new burst of magnificent scientific progress could now unleash a great accelerating wave of ever more rewarding labor back here on Earth and also within nearby space. Now, the launching of the great scientific triumph of Curiosity, which had struck the imagination of the world this week, must be recognized as the end of the idea of cheap labor, both inside the United States and throughout the world at large today. And he concludes the statement by writing, and this, by the way, was written for the labor rally in Philadelphia. He ends it by saying, the example of the recent triumph of the meaning of human life with the landing of Project Curiosity points out most clearly the most precious value of them all. What is the future we are giving to both those recently born and their successors? On this account, the recent three terms of office of our recent presidencies make an ugly spectacle of the very meaning of the lives which the present policies of our government have bequeathed to our citizens and their descendants. President John F. Kennedy, for example, understood this and knew better. Let the inspiration, LaRouche concludes, of the landing by Curiosity be the standard of true patriotism in human labor for today. Let skill, and science be the standard of life which we extend to a truly meaningful course of life for all of our citizens at last. Now, before we get to our main guest today, who you might know as the galactic weatherman from the LaRouche PAC site, Peter Martinson, to discuss the full scientific implications of Curiosity, which LaRouche is referring to, I want to bring in Diane Sayre. Diane was today in Philadelphia, as you know her, the listeners of this program know her from her role on the LaRouche congressional slate. But Diane was there with a brigade of mostly younger organizers to distribute this leaflet and intervene to turn this from just being a union rally of people protesting the grievances of the unions to actually discussing national issues. And so from Diane, we can get a report on this AFL-CIO rally today in Philadelphia. Diane, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, so you were there. It was a fairly decent-sized turnout. What was the general mood of the people who were there, and how did we intervene?
Well, I think it probably was around 15,000 or so, and people are very disgruntled, I would say is a good word. They're unhappy about the lack of jobs, the poverty. You know, this is the big issue. But there was nothing particularly inspiring coming from the podium, although it was noteworthy that Trump didn't endorse any candidates or any parties. He said, we're here to influence both conventions. However, when presented with real ideas, which we were doing, we had about 40 activists, and we got out probably 5,000-6,000 copies of LaRouche's statement, the policy platform. We had the Obama mustache posters, which just at the beginning, some people kicked one of the mustaches down, but after that, no problems. We had gigantic signs with pictures of Nawapa and Glass-Steagall. And the one thing that people are totally passionate about is Glass-Steagall. We had people seeking us out in the crowds that they would see a Glass-Steagall sign and come running over to sign the petition in support of H.R. 1489. I think we must have got about 300-plus signatures on that.
Now, Diane, just on that point, I'd like you to just give people a sense of that, how that's a change, because when you launched your congressional campaign, Glass-Steagall was not a dominant issue inside the labor movement.
No, that's right. People, one, weren't that familiar with it, and two, if they were, they didn't think it was that important, or it certainly wasn't a burning issue that people were passionate around. Now, in the wake of the LIBOR, you know, the $29 trillion of bailouts, the realization that this whole thing has been a giant ripoff, I would say people are quite ready for it and are quite impassioned about it.
And what was the response that we had to the leaflet of Remember John Kennedy, the impact of the space program, as opposed to fighting for a few scraps in the middle of a depression?
Well, everybody grabbed the leaflet. Virtually no one didn't take it, didn't want it. And as people were leaving, you were trying to get out more literature, and many people said, no, I've got it, and they hold it up and show it to you. So they were also hanging on to them. In some of the conversations, I brought up this Curiosity mission, and a lot of people weren't that aware, or they sort of remembered. I mean, it is outrageous. The media is not covering it. And when you would discuss it with people, I was saying, look, this means the end of free trade. This was done by the United States. And people would get, you'd see their faces light up. There'd be kind of a transformative affect and demeanor, like you were sparking something which they remembered as an identity. I mean, also there's enormous anger at the environmentalist movement, which people really see as the counter, the anti-science movement. I mean, these are builders, iron workers, steel workers, some teachers, the aerospace, machinists, and also the Air Traffic Controllers Union was there in force. So there was a great deal of receptivity to this message.
And Diane, the attitude toward the Obama administration, you said you had one case where someone reacted against us, but in general, the initial idea of this rally was to express the deep anger at the Democratic Party and at the president for not creating jobs, for having a convention in Charlotte, which is an anti-union, Charlotte, North Carolina is anti-union state, but in general, for having the sense that this president has done nothing to help Main Street or working people. Was that attitude generally there, and was it expressed?
Yes, it was expressed, although it was somewhat muted, although I found it striking, because some of the unions, I guess the Obama people were so alarmed that it would look like an anti-Obama rally. So some of the unions had everyone march in wearing these big Obama shirts. But then when you talk to these people, like many of them would contribute, they'd sign the petition, they'd come up to the table with a mustache. One guy was defending Obama. I said, you don't support Obama, you just hate Romney. He said, okay, that's right, you're right. And he signed up. So it's like a millimeter thick and maybe not even a yard wide.
And was there any chance to discuss with people the contrast between the miraculous achievements thus far of Curiosity versus Obama's trashing NASA and practically shutting down the program?
Yes, a lot of that was exactly what was being discussed at our tables. We had three separate organizing stations, which were just nonstop busy, often piled too deep with people gathered around to engage in conversation on that topic, sign the Glass-Steagall petition, et cetera.
And finally, Diane, this comes, of course, at a point at which the president is personally engaging in activity which could trigger World War III over a Libya-style intervention in Syria. It's coming at a point at which the president and his attorney general and treasury secretary are not just covering up the crimes of the banks, but are facilitating their continuing those crimes. To what extent do you think there's a recognition that this is an administration that is against the American people, against the interests of labor? LaRouche himself put out a statement earlier in the week in which he said that if Obama's reelected, the labor movement is dead. Do you think that we were able to get that through and that people will have an opportunity to think about that and reach that conclusion?
I hope we planted that seed in many people's minds. Unfortunately, I think people have become so pessimistic that this, what Lynn wrote on Kennedy and curiosity, is probably the best way possible to puncture the pessimism, because otherwise they don't even want to think about elections, politicians, candidates, president. They really, you can see their eyes glaze over when you say anything about the election. So what Lynn did with this approach on curiosity, Kennedy, and the question of mission is perhaps the one way that we're going to get people to actually make that realization conscious in their minds. And I don't think it's conscious on their minds yet. They just think they're unhappy and it's hopeless.
Well, with the Democratic Convention now 3.5 weeks away, it better dawn on them pretty quickly, because otherwise Obama is going to be renominated, a prospect which I think few of the people who were there could actually support.
Yes, I think that's right.
All right, any final thoughts from the day?
Well, one interesting moment, a journalist came up and was asking why the mustache, and I was briefing her on the situation with Syria, and then she said, well, I don't know all that much about this. I'm from France. And I said, oh, you know a great deal about this. You probably remember the campaign of Jacques Cheminade, which, of course, she was very well aware of. So I think it also just indicates the international reach and effect of what we're doing.
Well, I think it's also important for people in Europe to see this kind of resistance, even though it wasn't hundreds of thousands, because in Europe, the unions are being destroyed by the collapse of the euro and the imposition of austerity. It's not just the unions, it's the standard of living of people is being destroyed. That was LaRouche's point in his statement, that the standard of living is what's been assaulted by the combination of environmentalism and monetarism, British imperial
right.
policy. So, Diane, thank you very much for the report, and we'll probably have you on again soon, because we need to stay on top of this as we head into the crucial days in August and September. So thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
And now joining me, actually he's been on all the time, is Peter Martinson. Some of you have seen him on LaRouche PAC website, where he does periodic, I guess you'd call them cosmic weather forecasts. And Peter also was on this last week's weekly report with Ben Denniston and Lyndon LaRouche, in which there was a very exciting discussion with some animation, some pictures, photos, discussing this Mars mission. So I'd encourage people, beyond listening to the program today, and of course telling your friends to pick it up in the archive, but I'd encourage you to go back and watch the weekly report. And then I think, Peter, there was wasn't there a weather forecast put up this morning?
Yeah, I put up a weather report this morning. People can get that on the front page of the LaRouche PAC site.
Yeah, that's in the most recent developments. What did you say in that? What's the latest?
Well, the main thing, I used the report mainly to expand on the importance of the Mars Curiosity mission and what type of science is going to be done there. Because the main thing that I think people should just recognize with this little guy is first the landing on Sunday night, Monday morning was spectacular. I don't know if you saw it, Harley, but they were broadcasting it live from JPL, and the landing was way more perfect than anybody expected. Maybe some people in the control room expected it, but it landed less than 1.5 miles away from their target spot.
Peter, I was making the joke during the week that there are valet drivers in Los Angeles who have more time getting between two white lines than the rover did hitting the spot on Mars.
It was incredible. I mean, if you just imagine, this spacecraft traveled well over 100 miles through 100 million miles through space to get to Mars, and it shot directly at this one tiny little point in a rather small crater on Mars and hit it with an accuracy of a little bit more than a mile. It's absolutely incredible.
Now, in the mission itself, in the travel itself, this is not just a plan to get someplace and then do observations. They were taking observations along the way.
Yeah, there's an instrument on the on Curiosity called it's called the RAD. It's the
the radiation assessment detector.
Radiation assessment detector, which was running the whole time, or it took readings periodically. It's designed to measure specific forms of radiation, cosmic rays, ultraviolet radiation, gamma rays, energetic neutrons, and things like that, which are the types of radiation that you watch for because they're potentially dangerous for astronauts. And from what I understand, the shielding that they put on the spacecraft mimicked the shielding that you have on the International Space Station, which means that the radiation that this little experiment was measuring from inside of the spacecraft is pretty much exactly what an astronaut who was flying in something like the International Space Station between here and Mars would have experienced during such a long trip. And what they found is it was a whole lot of radiation.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I think that's important is that this was launched, as I understand, last November. And so if you were actually going to have a manned mission with this kind of spacecraft, that's probably too long for people to be sure we'd be able to have astronauts survive, which does bring up the whole question of nuclear-propelled rockets, including fusion.
Right. I mean, the way to kind of get a grip on this thing is that Curiosity is not a standalone mission. This is part of a program that was, you know, that's been in the middle of development since the 1940s, 1950s, when the original rocket scientists were pushing for getting people into space. We need to get people off the Earth and to these other planets, specifically to Mars as a first destination. There are various plans right now that are underway to design, you know, spacecraft that could get to Mars more rapidly than others, but almost all of them, almost all of the ones that are under current investigation depend on a very long voyage, which is around 200, 250 days from Earth to Mars, which is very long. You'd need to have very thick shielding to shield the astronauts from the radiation that Curiosity experienced. But you'd also have to have some way to mitigate the effects of microgravity on specifically changes in bone density, because the bones degrade when people are in space, and it's not clear why. Exercise doesn't mitigate it. So you'd have to have some way to deal with the bone loss. LaRouche's idea, which is, I think, the most interesting and beautiful idea, is to make spacecraft that accelerate constantly the whole trip at around one Earth gravity, maybe more, maybe a little bit less. Maybe you'd want to change it before you got to Mars so that you'd reach, you know, Mars gravity inside the ship. But the trip would take about a week, so the radiation wouldn't be much of a problem. And the people would be experiencing an artificial gravity situation, which means that their bones would most likely not degrade unless there's some type of an electromagnetic component that we're not aware of yet. But the only way you can make a spacecraft like that is with fusion power.
And Peter, I assume from what you're saying that the people who designed this mission and the people they're working with actually are thinking beyond this. They are thinking about sending out more missions of this sort and also manned missions.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that people should, you know, Mars or NASA did a really good job organizing for this. NASA does, they organize kind of like the LaRouche movement does. They do something absolutely incredible, and then they go around telling as many people as they can about it, and then they use that to put pressure on the government for more funding for better and better projects. NASA, at least a month before the landing, put out a video called 7 Minutes of Terror, which, you know, went viral on the Internet, which showed the what happens in the entry, descent, and landing phase of Curiosity with this sky crane operation, which looks, you know, harrowing and terrifying, but which, you know, comes about as a process of reason. NASA put that out and advertised it all over the place. News, you know, news organizations picked it up, and people started spreading it. And the last week before the landing, the coverage became much more intense. But the thing that NASA kept, every time there was an interview of a NASA official, the NASA official would emphasize that this mission is one step towards a manned mission to Mars. So, like, a lot of people were emphasizing this radiation experiment that we just talked about. But they all, NASA made very clear in their organizing that this mission is designed as a step in the direction of a manned landing.
That's
part of a larger project.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is Saturday, August 11th, 2012, and we're talking with Peter Martinson from The Basement, the LaRouche Pack TV, and Peter has a background in astronomy. He's worked on this for years, and, you know, Peter, I think along with what you were just saying, the NASA's public relations work, which oftentimes is weak because they have not, I don't think they've effectively fought the dismantling of the agency that's gone on under Bush and then accelerated under Obama. But for this mission, they did generate enough excitement that there were crowds of enthusiastic people at JPL, at, I think, Goddard Space Center, at even in Times Square.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they showed it on the big screen right underneath the New Year's Eve ball that drops on New Year's Eve. So this was, it was a very popular event. It rivaled the coverage of the Olympic Games, which are, you know, happening right now. And, you know, LaRouche made a point today about that, that what you have under the Obama administration is a youth generation, you know, in college or recently out of college, who's been beat down and is totally demoralized because, you know, the job prospects stink. The future looks like a future of more budget cuts and terrible policies, more wars, terrible policies coming out of specifically the Obama administration and out of a Congress that is not fighting the Obama administration or the Bush administration before Obama. But what this represented to the youth generation is a victory against all of the stupid policies which destroyed the future. Because this represents man has just landed on Mars again with a huge, you know, mechanical creature that will act as our sense organ on another planet. It's a huge victory against the demoralization and defeatist attitude that's been bred into the youth generation. So this is a spectacular event in those terms. It actually remoralized a whole section of the population.
You know, one of the lines that came in after the decision was made to end the Apollo program and scale back the space program to just the shuttle missions was, one of the lines that came out was, well, why don't we spend the money doing things here on Earth? You know, why spend all this money to go into space when we're not doing things on Earth? Well, of course, the irony is that over the last 20 years, we haven't been investing in programs on Earth. We've had no scientific and technological progress on Earth. We've had a reversal. The only so-called science has been miniaturization of computers. And, in fact, the best part of that came out of the NASA program. So I think this idea that all of a sudden we once again see big science, you know, people get the big picture, that we're here for some purpose other than to miniaturize cell phones to be able to watch television on our telephones, but actually that we have a mission in the universe. I think that's part of what so excited Lyndon LaRouche and what he's been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, LaRouche said that this event, the landing specifically, it recontextualizes everything. You have to put everything into this context now. The potential threat of thermonuclear war between the U.S. and Russia, which is being driven by the British, the collapse of the banking system, all of these things are now recontextualized with this.
Well, now, Peter, what I'd like to do is take a few minutes to go through some of the science of this project, because we started out talking about the RAD and its observations, its ability to make observations about cosmic radiation in flight. Has it started generating back measurements of radiation on Mars?
Yeah, sir. That's kind of the point that I was making in the weather report and also on the weekly report. Pretty much all this little guy has done is landed on Mars, and right now it's going through a series of diagnostics and tests in order to make sure that all of the instrumentation is working properly. The only things that it's sent back of actual scientific value, there's scientists are funny. They kind of grasp at anything. One of the things that people are studying are pictures of the actual rover and looking at what types of rocks and dust were kicked up and landed on the rover from the rockets that landed the thing. And that's going to give them some indication of what the materials are that are under the wheels of the rover.
Huh.
But in terms of actual science with the instruments, none of that's been done yet. There are a couple of photographs that were taken from the navigational cameras, which tell the drivers where the rover is. And there's one picture which was taken by the what are called the mast cams, which are they're kind of like the two eyes on what's called the mast, but it's like the head of the rover. Mm-hmm. And they're at about eye level of an average-sized human. There's been one photograph taken with that, which shows the slope of where Curiosity is headed, which is a mountain in the middle of this crater, which is a very, very exciting place to travel, which is what I go through in the weather report, because nothing's really been done yet. All we know is we have an idea and several hypotheses of what this crater is and what created it and what potentially Curiosity is going to find, but it hasn't done any actual studies yet on the surface.
Now, as I understand, there are something like 10 instruments on it. A lot of what they're going to be doing is evaluating the material on Mars for purposes of putting together a geological history to look at the possibility for life. Give us a sense of the scope of the project, because I don't think most people know, I certainly don't, what the 10 instruments are, and we don't have to go through each of them, but what is it that this mission in itself hopes to do, and then we'll take a look at how to build upon it later.
Well, look at what an actual geologist or a geochemist does. A geologist's job, a geochemist's job, is to determine what is the history of an area of rock formation on the surface of the Earth or on any other planetary hard body. Their tools are a variety of things. The most important tool is usually the rock hammer to break off chunks of rock. But there's also magnifying glass, like a jeweler's magnifying glass, so that you can see the crystal structure inside of a rock and how the crystals are arranged. But the mostly what geologists and geochemists do is you have to get really, really fine detail to find out what are the rocks made of, what are the elements that compose the rock, what are the molecules composed of those elements. How are they arranged? What is the what types of minerals, what types of crystals are inside of the rock?
And how do they discover that? Because I understand it involves a system of lasers and spectral analysis that sounds quite complicated, but fascinating.
There's a whole suite of instruments on this little guy. One is what you just mentioned. It's called the ChemCam, which is also on the top of the mast. It shoots a laser which can shoot out several meters at a rock surface and vaporizes the top layers of that rock. And the camera inside the instrument can look at the gas that's emitted from that little spot on the rock and can determine roughly what the composition of that rock was that was vaporized based on the gas that was emitted. Now, that's the what I think is the least exact measurement that this thing can do. If the rover can get up to a face of rock, it can put up against a little instrument that does an X-ray analysis of the mineral, which tells you basically what the gross crystal structure is inside of it, and also what types of elements are inside of it. Now, it can also drill off a section of the rock into dust, essentially, and there are several little chambers that it can dump the dust into on the body of the rover, which will do analysis of the dust. It does a chemical analysis. There's a gas chromatograph, which vaporizes some of the material and looks at the spectrum which is emitted. There's several X-ray spectrometers on the in these little instruments, which can determine very precisely what types of elements and the abundances of the elements.
Hmm.
They're essentially like noses on the craft that it dumps the material into. So it can pretty much do everything that a geologist or a geochemist can do. One thing that would be very interesting, obviously, which is why the landing site was picked, is to search for evidence. We know that there was water in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Water
in this particular area.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the big reasons why this thing was, why this crater was picked. There's a lot of evidence that this crater was used to be filled with water. There's actually, this is something that's very interesting. The mound in the middle, first of all, satellites have been able to document that you can see layers of rock on this mound, which means that the mountain itself is not something that was, like, pushed up. It's not a piece of volcanic rock that was just pushed up. It's a pile of sedimentary layers that were laid down over a long time. There's evidence that there were intervals where there was more deposition of the sedimentary, like sand, essentially, and times when there wasn't a lot of deposition. Instead, there was erosion of the layers. But this thing was built up and built up and built up. The current hypothesis is that the entire crater was completely buried at a certain point in its history by sediments that were laid down by water, and that at some point later on, the water disappeared, and wind erosion took over and ground down and essentially excavated a large portion of this crater and left this mountain in the middle, which is a record of this series of inundations with water and laying down of sediment and then receding of the water.
So even if there's no water that can be found on the surface now, from this kind of evaluation, you can determine there had been water.
Yeah. There was evidence that there were periods of liquid running water on Mars back at the earliest, when we sent Mariner back in the 1960s and early 70s. The whole Mariner program established that there are features on Mars that cannot be explained except under the assumption that there was running, flowing water, lots of water at some point on Mars. So the big question is, where is all the water now?
And also, if you have water, then you might have had the capacity for microbial life or simple life. Is that a possibility?
One of the criteria for a selection of the landing site is to find somewhere that looks like it's the most habitable spot on Mars. And this crater looks like, because there was all this evidence of water, it looks like this would be one of the best places to look for at least evidence of life that existed a long, long time ago, billions of years ago, and perhaps life that exists right now. Now, there's no instrument on the rover that will search specifically for signs of life, but it is designed to search for, it doesn't test to see if there's some kind of organism in the
right
in the dirt, but it can test for byproducts of organisms which have been left in the rock, like isotope analysis of the rocks.
And also, Peter, I assume that going back to RAD, that part of its function is going to be to have a constant measure of radiation levels to give us a better sense of what possibly could survive on Mars.
Right, exactly. What could survive, and if we send living creatures to Mars, perhaps like an experimental set of organisms or people, what types of radiation would you receive if you're on the surface of Mars? There might be radiation coming from the ground, for all we know. But yeah, that there's also another device that has the capability of measuring radiation, which was designed by the Russians, called the DAN, which is, let me just pick this up here, dynamic albedo of neutrons, which senses energetic neutrons, but it also has the ability to shoot streams of neutrons into the ground, which penetrate, several inches up to several yards into the ground, and they reflect off of surfaces that are wet, surfaces that have water. So this is it's a radiation experiment, but it's designed to detect water that's, underground up to a depth of 1 or 2 meters, potential aquifers that are underground.
Uh-huh. Now, Peter, from what I understand, this is powered not by wind or solar power, but it actually is nuclear powered. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is all of the other rovers that we've sent to Mars. Well, with the exception of the Viking landers, have been powered mainly by solar power. So Sojourner back in the 90s, and then the two Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, those are all solar powered. And the Phoenix lander was also solar powered, which is very useful because the sun's always going to be there. One of the problems is that the solar panels can be covered by dust, and then it reduces the amount of actual usefulness of the solar panels. The Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity, on the other hand, is powered by a source of plutonium-238, which is radioactive. It's not going to detonate like a nuclear bomb or anything like that. It's not a fission reactor.
So this is not a secret Obama plan to test nuclear weapons on Mars.
No, although that would be really awesome if only he would do some kind of a experiment like that. No, this thing, all it does is it uses the heat provided from the radioactive decay of the plutonium-238 to drive what's called a thermocouple, which is it's a material that generates a current when it's heated up. It's similar to the phenomena of piezoelectricity, where you squeeze a crystal and it produces electricity. Mm-hmm. Some of those piezoelectric crystals, when you heat them, will actually produce a current. So this is essentially a radioactive battery on this thing, and we've been using these for a long time. The Voyager spacecraft had the same type of battery. Mm-hmm. A bunch of the craft that we sent to the moon back during the Apollo program were powered by these radioisotope batteries. Now, the problem is that we don't produce, plutonium-238 is not something that you dig up out of the ground. It's a decay product from uranium that you get out of actual nuclear functioning fission reactor. The problem is that we don't have a program in the United States anymore to produce this isotope. So we have a little bit of a stockpile of it inside the United States. Apparently the Russians have a stockpile too, but they decided that they don't want to sell anymore to the Americans, probably because they want to use it for their own spacecraft. And there's very little left anywhere else in the world. So in order to have this type of a project again, we need to crank up the production of these nuclear isotopes for use in these batteries, which means we need to revive the whole nuclear program inside the United States.
Maybe we could buy them from Iran instead of going to war against them.
Yeah, exactly. We could buy the isotopes for batteries and also the isotopes for medical purposes from Iran.
Yeah. Now, Peter, I think the other thing that struck me from your presentation on the weekly report, and again, if people want to see more of what Peter had to say on this with Lyndon LaRouche's comments and also in conjunction with Ben Denniston, this last Wednesday, the weekly report on LaRouchePack.com had a very fascinating discussion. But you talked about that we're beginning to get an array of instruments up there. I think you said this is now 5 instruments we have on Mars, and it begins to get at this question of building up an adequate platform from which we can get a better view not only of what's going on in Mars, but in the space around Mars. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Mars is definitely the hottest target in our solar system besides the Earth. Going back to the Mariner program, we've orbited, not just us, but also the Russians and Europeans have orbited, and also the Japanese, have orbited satellites around Mars. Right now, the suite of satellites that we have include the Mars Odyssey, which is an American satellite designed to do very detailed mapping. The Europeans,
that's still operating, right?
Oh, yeah, it's still operating. We have the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is, it's doing similar. It's taking very detailed pictures of Mars and also taking thermal images of Mars in the infrared, which gives you an indication of what types of rock you're looking at. Because, like, the Europeans have a satellite called the Mars Express, which does a similar job. So we have 3 satellites right now orbiting Mars, several of which, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is used to relay messages between Curiosity and the Earth. Right. We also have another rover on Mars, which is still functioning, Opportunity, which is, it's traveled an ungodly distance on Mars, and it's been functioning for the past 8 years and is now embarking on a new exploration of another crater. So yeah, this is, around Mars is a full infrastructure. There's a communications infrastructure and also an infrastructure on the ground, which for all intents and purposes should be built up as a full infrastructure. Now,
Well, what can we expect? I mean, Ben talked in the program about how this can be used as part of a broader program for strategic defense of Earth, the initiative that was made by the Russians and that was, in a sense, an extension of Lyndon LaRouche's original SDI policy to protect us from asteroids and also give us a better insights into what we're dealing with as we go through this plane of the galaxy. How does this work to extend the sensorium? How effective is it to have Mars as a base?
Well, there's 2 aspects of that. First of all, most of the asteroids in the solar system that we know of are between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. All the planets in closer to the sun than the asteroid belt are these small rocky bodies, right? Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. I mean, you've got this, pile of rubble, which either was a planet that had formed and disintegrated, or was a planet that couldn't, that tried to form but couldn't quite form. It's a very disharmonic orbit, as determined by Kepler and then later on Gauss.
But these generally stay within that orbit, right?
The asteroids?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there are other asteroids outside outside that orbit, but they're always associated with the larger planets. Like There's a whole slew of asteroids which are associated with the orbit of Jupiter. Another bunch associated with the orbit of Saturn. But within the orbit of the asteroid belt, there's a pile of asteroids. The ones that we're looking at most are these near-Earth asteroids, which cross the orbit of the Earth because they have very elliptical orbits or because their orbits are very similar to the Earth. Those are the ones that we want to watch out for and the ones that we need to catalog. And there are programs on the Earth to watch the sky and pick out new asteroids and things like that. But I think LaRouche's concept of the strategic defense of the Earth is that we want to be able to control the entire space inside of Mars's orbit. So that means you can't have spacecraft at every point inside of that orbit. You need to pick specific strategic choke points in order to control the space. The planets are the most important strategic control points. So we do want to have an observation network on Mars. We also need to have an observation network at Mercury. Right now we have 1 satellite orbiting Mercury called the Messenger, which is doing a very exciting mapping of the planet and a mapping of the types of materials that, that you find on the surface and the interaction with the sun, which is much more detailed than anybody even imagined. But that would be the place where you'd want to search for asteroids that might hit the Earth, because it's at Mercury, at a close point to the sun. We had the widest field of view around the sun, which is where you can pick out all the asteroids that could potentially hit the Earth.
But don't we have some kind of mission toward Mercury?
No, right now we just have the Messenger. We have an orbiter that's orbiting Venus, the Venus Express,
yeah,
right, which is European, and we have a satellite that's currently orbiting Saturn, the Cassini. We have another satellite that's right now headed towards Jupiter. It's supposed to reach Jupiter in 2016, I think, called the Juno probe. It's a polar orbiting satellite. It'll be very exciting. And then there's a last one, which is hurtling at breakneck speed towards Pluto. It's supposed to pass by Pluto in, I think, 2015. So we have an array of devices which are looking at each of the... Oh, and we also have one satellite that's orbiting Vesta, the asteroid Vesta. That's another thing. We'd want to have a whole set of observing instruments in the asteroid belt in order to control the entire area. But we have one in there right now and a couple others that have passed by. The Chinese are sending a satellite out to swing by one of the asteroids right now also.
Well, I know in this coming issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, we're going to have a timeline of the taking down of NASA, the persistent policy of Obama to cut back spending on these kinds of programs. And from what you're describing, while this is all very exciting, we should be gearing this up by an order of magnitude, it seems like. So I think this is one of the key things that when our listeners are listening to you and they're fascinated by what you're saying, they should realize that this is now a time for us to act. Just as the Glass-Steagall issue has become a critical issue at a point of the breakdown of the euro system and the dollar system, the whole transatlantic, and it becomes the starting point of a change. When NWAPA becomes an issue for the collapse of jobs and infrastructure, we actually should look at this space program as the ultimate driver. If you think about what NASA provided in the 60s and 70s, we're now looking at a capability that's not just needed for longer-term concerns, but also for transforming the way we think about our planet. And I'd like to also just throw out to you for your thoughts on this. This becomes the basis of collaboration with Russia and China, as opposed to confrontation over Syria or Iran. So what can you tell us about the potential for U.S.-Russian collaboration at this point?
Well, yeah, this is very important. Obama, stated his intentions to slash NASA by an impressive amount back when he was running for president, back starting in 2007. The guy hates NASA and hates space exploration, probably because it's a British agent, and the British hate, science.
Well, and they hate the idea that the human mind is something more than a receptor of senses.
Exactly. Now, when Obama came in, the first thing he did to NASA was slash the budget for Constellation, which is it was supposed to be the follow-on to the shuttle for the manned space program. The next thing he did is he slashed the budget for planetary exploration, and specifically Mars exploration. He cut the budget for Mars exploration by almost half of its current operating budget, which means that NASA could not provide even half the funding for something like Curiosity to happen again. Now, the first result of that is that the United States pulled out of its commitment to the European Space Agency to assist in a future, part of this developing Mars infrastructure, which the Europeans called ExoMars, which consisted of an orbiter, an orbiting satellite, and a lander, which was designed to land on Mars and hunt down the most interesting samples of rock and then ferret those samples of rock into a cache, which would then be retrieved by a future mission. This is the decadal mission for Mars exploration, is to bring material back from Mars. This mission that the Europeans
Obama pulled us out completely of that.
We're out of it completely. So the Europeans said, well, you know, screw you guys. We're going to go talk to the Russians. And the part that we were supposed to play in that was to actually launch the lander and the orbiter into space and then transport them to the other planet. We pulled out of that, so now Russia stepped in and said, we will launch these spacecraft. Now, the problem is that Russia, in the recent period, has demonstrated that its ability to launch spacecraft into space successfully is very tough. You know, they lost the Phobos Grunt mission.
Right.
Just a couple of days ago, they lost just a simple launch of two telecom satellites to a launch failure. So they have a big problem in being able to launch things, and so it's a potential danger to the future success of this European mission. What the United States should do is increase its funding overall for NASA and get back in the project, not because Russia can't do it anymore, but to recognize that we want to work with Russia, because Russia is a potential very powerful ally in space exploration and everything else. We need Russia to get back to greatness, which it used to have. You know, they were almost the first ones to Mars. They were the first ones to ever land anything on Mars.
Right.
We want them to get back to that state of greatness, and so we should aid them in this type of a project. And this would translate to all other aspects of collaboration with the Russians.
Well, this also goes to the Russian proposal, which I believe it was initiated by Russia to have a strategic defense of Earth.
Yeah, and the Russian coverage of it was specifically a revival of, it was an echo of the LaRouche's strategic defense initiative. We're going to collaborate based on defending humans against extinction, and through that collaboration, we're going to build both countries up and defuse the tensions.
Peter, I have more questions than we have time for. We have only about 8 minutes left, but I wanted to ask about the relationship of the programs to the moon to what we're doing with Mars. I know the Chinese have I believe they're orbiting the moon, and they have fairly aggressive plans for that. How does that fit in? Is the moon an industrial stepping stone for building up the infrastructure on Mars?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the moon is, that is the Earth's real space station. We should have things like the International Space Station, but the moon is somewhere that we've demonstrated we can get to with technology from the 1960s. We should certainly be able to get that back if we had the budget for it. Building up the moon would be, it's the ultimate space base. For one thing, the most difficult part of getting anything into space is what we're just talking about with the Russians. It's getting things into space off of the Earth, because you have to travel through a very thick ocean of atmosphere against a very strong gradient of, you know, gravity. It's really tough to launch things into orbit from the Earth. Launching things into orbit from the moon is a lot easier.
So it's an ideal industrial base, then?
It's the perfect launch base for, it's a perfect launch base for spacecraft. It's the perfect industrial construction site for not only spacecraft, but also fusion power systems. One thing that limits the construction of anything on the Earth is that, you know, the size of what you can build, because things will collapse on themselves. On the moon, you can build huge structures. You can build huge fusion power devices in order to study the processes of fusion and the processes of the atoms. So yes, that is the ultimate current goal for industrialization, as a launch pad into the rest of the solar system to control.
So a colonization, in the sense of the moon, is something that would be of absolute importance.
Right now, the Chinese are the only ones who have an active mission to do that. The Russians have stated their intent to go back to the moon as the prime mission for their space program. It should be the primary intent for the United States to get, you know, it was interesting. Popovkin, who's the head of the Russian Space Agency, stated back when SpaceX launched its little capsule to the International Space Station, everyone's all excited about the potential of commercialized space. Popovkin made a good point. He said, look, that demonstrated that the primary responsibility of governments in space doesn't lie in low Earth orbit. We can use private companies for that. The primary responsibility for governments is to do what currently is extremely possible, which is going to deep space, which means going to Mars or at least going to the moon. So, yeah, it's absolutely strategic that we get back to the moon as an international collaboration among governments.
And Peter, I guess the final point, which is never very far from Mr. LaRouche's thoughts, is this question of man's capacity to expand our realm of activity, and that this is largely a question of opening up the imagination. And certainly what you've been discussing this last 40 minutes or so, I hope our listeners have thought about it and begin to realize this, how small we've become, how limited our perspective is on the area in which man can operate. And I'd like you to just say something on that, because I think it's a good way to leave our listeners intrigued with the question of their own potential imagination.
Yeah, this is LaRouche's favorite point about the whole thing. Man is not a being of the flesh. Man is not primarily a physical expression. Man is primarily a force of creativity in what, you know, we call the mind, which is not a sensible object. The senses that we use they're an aid. We need the senses so that we, you know, can sense the universe. But we don't know the universe by the senses. We have to juxtapose the senses to sniff out what are the invisible processes, which are always commensurate with mental processes that drive what we can sense. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at with the Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity, this is a miraculous sense organ. The whole thing is constructed and shaped in order to serve the purpose of producing specific new sense perceptions, which in combination can allow the human mind to actually be transported to Mars and understand what are the processes that are driving not just Mars, but what are the processes that created the solar system, created the galaxy, and created not just life, but what created man? What is our purpose in the universe?
And that's underway right now with the rover in terms of the people working with it.
Yeah, these guys live on Mars right now. Mars' day is like 24 and a half hours. So these people are living on Martian time scale. But yeah, they're getting data from the rover. Right now they're getting data, which is diagnostic data. But they have to put that together to put together an imaginative image of what's really happening on the surface of this other planet, which you can't see with your regular senses. So Lynn's point is actually really interesting. That means that the senses that are built into your biology are, in a sense, synthetic senses, which are able to be used as effectively as the sense perceptions that we've built and put on this little spacecraft. But they're used by the mind in order to come up with, in order to determine what are the real invisible, unsensed principles that are generating the sense perceptions that we're perceiving.
We're going to have to leave it at that. That's quite a provocative thought, I think, for people. And it should be, because what we're talking about is something which is magnificent, something which goes far beyond anything that people are generally engaged in their day-to-day businesses. But if you actually think about it and take in what this means, you realize that we can't survive as a nation by cutting, by reducing populations, reducing costs. And I think that's the important provocation LaRouche put in his statement today that we distributed in Philadelphia, where he said that we have ended the era of cheap labor. And what you're talking about in terms of the mind is actually the way real productivity gains take place. So, Peter, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. This has been a fascinating discussion. People, as I said, can go back to the LaRouchePack.com website under the weekly report to get a more discussion of this. You can also see Peter's periodic weather forecast. I assume we'll see a few more of those now.
Yeah, I'm going to do a weekly update specifically on Mars.
Okay, and I know that there are a number of video projects being prepared by the LaRouche Pack team in Purcellville to keep people up to date and actually ahead of the date, so to speak. So thank you for joining us today. And again, Peter, thank you. This has been the LaRouche Show for Saturday, August 11th, 2012, and we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern.